So I'd like to remind you where we were. No, sorry, what's the goal? So everything we did in the last couple Wednesdays depended on wishful thinking, so that the configuration space integrals, their exterior derivative, only depended on the principal boundaries of configuration space, meaning those in which only two points coincide. And the wishful thinking is that everything else disappeared. It doesn't matter. All other clustering doesn't matter. So the goal for today is to remove most of this wishful thinking, though not all. Okay? But let me remind you again where we were. So, well, we had a complex of graphs and a complex of differential forms over the space of all embeddings, and there was a map between them, and I only want to concentrate on the part of the complex that may generate not invariants, so the degree zero piece, and this is trivalent graphs, and the degree one piece, and this is one quadrivalent graph, so graphs that are all trivalent, that all of whose vertices are trivalent except for one vertex, which is quadrivalent. And then this IN map, integration map, involved push forward along the fibers of this configuration space vibration, and it made sense both for trivalent graphs and for one quadrivalent graphs. And at least modulo wishful thinking, we know that if we have, so at modulo wishful thinking, this commutes. And therefore, if you have a homology class here, if you have a cohomology class here, you can push it to a cohomology class here, and therefore, which means a function on the space of knots whose differential is equal to zero, which means constant, which means a knot invariant. Now, what's a homology class, a cohomology class here? It's something in the kernel of D, okay? And well, and I guess we want to see if it actually works, okay? But before that, we said, let's pack all of these potential invariants to a single thing. So instead of, right, we have a map which maps H0 to invariants. So instead, I could dualize and get a map. I guess I'll call it A. I could dualize it and get a map from the dual of invariants. Well, the dual of invariants is a big space, but in particular, it contains the knots themselves. Okay, so knots are an element in the dual of invariants. So in particular, we get a map from knots into the dual of H0, and this map contains in it all the potential invariants that we could have gotten this way. So that was Z0. So Z0 was the sum over all n of the dual of the nth I map, and it goes from knots to, well, now it's the direct sum because I summed over all n's, so I in fact completed because it's an infinite sum, so a sum over all n's of H0 of the first cohomology of this complex dualized. Okay? And then last time we studied this a little bit, and well, first of all, the dual of the kernel, right? The cohomology is the kernel. So the dual of the kernel is the dual of the vector space divided by the image of the adjoint. So so this is isomorphic to D, the space of diagram, divided by the adjoint. And last time, this seemed to have great potential because D is the map that collapses edges to form quadrivalent vertices. So its adjoint would break up the one quadrivalent vertex in all possible ways, and that at least looks like it would be IHX if the quadrivalent vertex is internal, and STU if the quadrivalent vertex is skeletal. Okay? However, last time we found that there were coefficients that made it messy, and I asserted without proof that if you, instead of sort of naively taking the dual of the space of diagram, you use duality relative to a certain slightly non-obvious inner product, then it actually works. Then the image of D star is indeed exactly IHX and STU. So the assertion, okay, so this assertion, there's nothing to say, nothing to prove, but the assertion that if you model out diagrams by the image of D star, you get precisely A, which is D modulo IHX and STU, is yet to be proven, and I still wish to postpone it. So this is still later. Okay? And here I'm just reminding you what the inner product was. So a diagram inner product with another diagram is the delta function, the naive inner product would be to take the delta function, but instead I'm taking the delta function multiplied by the number of automorphisms of the diagram. We checked it in a small example last time, and I still owe you a general statement. Okay, but the goal for today is to remove most of wishful thinking, but first I want to do the other parts of the goal. So I want to give you a more explicit formula for Z0, for Z0, and I want to tell you, well, if it works, why is it the thing that we actually really want? Why does it solve our problem? Okay? So, first of all, you know, this formula, as it is quite abstract. It's the adjoint of a crazy map into a dual space, so I want to simplify it a little bit. Okay? So I claim that this, in fact, so Z0 is in fact equal to the sum over all diagrams. You know, I kind of will put underscore just to underscore is D underscore is the same as the upper score, except sort of with a funny duality, okay? Except when I pair elements of the underscore with elements of the upper score, I have this funny factor. So it's a sum over all elements in D lower score, I claim, of D divided by the order of the automorphism group of D, multiplied by, well, you see, if D is a diagram, sorry, I should have said D0. If D is a diagram, you can integrate it, and you get a function on knots. So just evaluate this function. So take the integral corresponding to the diagram and evaluate it on the knot gamma. So this is Z0 evaluated on some knot gamma. Alternatively, this is the sum over all diagrams in D0 of D divided by the order of the automorphism group of D times, and now I just copy what this means, okay? So it's the integral over the configuration, sorry, the configuration space corresponding to the diagram D and the node gamma. So all ways of putting vertices in some vertices on space and some vertices on the node as specified by the node, by the diagram D. Whenever you have such many such ways, you get a directional view map phi sub D for each internal edge. So it's a map into a power of S2, where you get as many element, as many S2s as there are internal edges, and then you use this map to pull back the volume form of the sphere, raised to the number of components you need. Okay? So that's my claim. Okay? I suppose I should put here the word claim. And it's not really a proof. I will not sort of honor it by putting the word proof here, because this is just checking definitions, following definitions, checking the duality, that's what the adjoint means. Okay, so let's check it nevertheless. Okay, so what does it mean? How is the adjoint of a map defined? Gee, I hope I remember. So, suppose you have. Am I wasting your time? Or should I leave it as an exercise? Okay, I'll say it very briefly. So, suppose you have a vector space V and a vector space W and a map Z. Going from, it's not Z, it's I. Oh, and I sounds too much like the identity. It's I and it's not the identity. And you have a map going from here to here, and you have an inner product on this vector space, and an inner product on that vector space. Right? Then you will get an adjoint map going from W back to V, and the definition of this is that what's the definition? You take sort of what's the properties that define the adjoint map? Well, you have to take a vector V, lowercase v, inside here, and a vector lowercase w inside here. And the property is that if you take v, apply I to it, and pair it with w using the inner product of w, so this is now the inner product of w, and we also have an inner product of v, then this should be the same as taking V and pairing it with I dual of W using the double inner product of W. Right? Did I define adjoint correctly? I hope. Okay?
Right. I'm supposed to be in the product.
Mm-hmm. What?
V? The second, the right hand side.
In the product of V.
This is the inner product of V, right? The one that makes sense. So I have to do is to verify that this holds for Z0, and I have to choose sort of a vector, a vector that will play the role of W. So I have to choose a d upper bar, and let's call it d upper bar prime, And I have to choose something that will play the role of V. But the thing that plays the role of V is a knot. I don't take an D upper bar plays the role of V, and I have to choose something that will play the role of W, and the thing that plays the role of W is something in the dual of this, but the dual of this is, well, I'm not making my assertion for all of the dual of this, I'm only making the assertion for the part which is knots, so I have to choose a knot. So the thing that plays the role of W is gamma, and then let's just and then what is the thing to verify? I have to verify that the pairing of Z0 of gamma I'm actually writing the second term first, sorry. So I'm supposed to verify that the pairing of Z0 of gamma with, right, because Z0 is the thing which is the adjoint, with D bar prime is equal to the pairing of the diagram D bar prime with the knot using IN. So the pairing of the knot gamma with IN of D bar prime. Oops, sorry, came out a bit dense. Now, how do you pair IN with a knot? You just evaluate, right? The pairing of knots with invariants was just evaluation. So this was just IN of D bar prime evaluated on gamma. And this, on the other hand, is, well, it's this huge sum taken over here of the inner product, sorry, let's take it in this form, of the inner product of D prime with some diagram D. But the only diagram that will contribute is the diagram D prime, because the inner product is a delta. And it will contribute the order of the automorphism group, which appears here in the denominator. So therefore, the result here is what remains, so this. So the result here is I of D prime evaluated on gamma, and these two are indeed the same. Sorry, I mean this was a game in linear algebra. Okay, so that was the first claim before the main part of the class today. And here is the second claim, and the second claim is almost meaningless, but it's more valuable, so I'll call it a proposition. And well, it's sort of the key point, okay? So the claim is that if it is invariant, then Z0, so if Z0 is invariant, then it's the invariant we wanted, okay? And in fact, so assuming it's invariant, the proof that it's what we wanted is sort of easy, so we do it first. So the claim is that if Z0 is invariant, then it is a universal finite type invariant. So it solves the problem posed on Monday. Solving Monday's problem. Okay? So maybe before I do it, I have to remind you what is a universal finite type invariant. So a universal finite type invariant should have the following property. If you take a knot k singular, k which is n singular, whose underlying chord diagram D, sorry, whose own underlying chord diagram is D, so this is an n chord diagram. So basically, the picture is the knot could have looked something like this. Sorry, I wanted two singular. And then the underlying chord diagram is, well, in this case, it's this. And the claim is that if you compute Z of such a knot K, what you get, well, the long form of writing it is to say that, well, it's an element in, it should be an element in the direct sum of spaces of chord diagrams, and it should be 0 up to degree n, and then in degree n, it should be the diagram itself, and after that, it's, I don't care, right? And alternatively, I could just write it as, or more precisely, it's the class of D within the space A. Okay? So inside AN. And alternatively, I could have just written it as the class of D plus higher order terms. Okay? So now, given the reminder, let's prove the proposition. So I don't think I want to prove the, you know, I don't want to write a formal proof because it will take too long and it's too easy. It's not worthy of that. So let's compute Z0 of the sample knot that we have, okay? So let's compute it on, this and see what happens. So this is by definition, Z0, right? You first have to extend Z0 to singular knots. So this is by definition, Z0 of the thing that you get by resolving the crossing over here to be a positive crossing. Yeah. Sorry, my I never knew how to draw. Oh, here it's this way. Right. Minus Z0 evaluated on what you get when this is resolved to a negative crossing. This is still a double point. And each of these is further resolved. Okay? But the point is, well, okay, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to make the distance between the overstrand and the lower strand tiny. Okay, I'm going to make this resolution very, very fine, and since Z0 is invariant, I can do it. Okay? Now, when I try to evaluate Z0 on this, or more precisely on this where this double point resolved, okay, I end up computing various configuration space integrals. So various integrals corresponding to pictures like this. Okay? But the part of the integral, the contribution to the integral coming from a picture like this in which all skeleton legs are far away from the crossings that I'm now discussing, must be zero, is zero, because I take the difference between this and that, And there is no difference unless I have a leg that fills the place where I make the little distinction. Okay? So the conclusion is that to see anything, indifference, your diagram must have a leg near the double point. But in fact, it must have two legs near the double points. Right? Because you see, I could have done this flip either by moving the upper strand a tiny bit, or by moving the tiny bit down, or by taking the lower strand and moving it a tiny bit up. So also, I must have a leg near the lower end. Otherwise, I cannot tell the difference between over and under. Likewise, I must have a leg here, and I must have a leg here. Okay? Now, since I have n double points, I must have at least 2n vertices to start with. So the diagram must be of at least degree n. Okay? So I've already dealt with this. I've proven that all of these are zero. But what do I have in degree n? Now, the only way I can get a diagram of degree n with 2n skeleton legs is if it is 2n chords. Right? If I had another vertex in the inside, the degree would be more. And I only care about degree n. So the only way I could still get something that happens in degree n is that if these legs would connect to each other. Now, if this leg connects to here, so, you know, I'm sorry for the picture. This is supposed to be a straight line. Okay? Right? It's supposed to be an edge in the diagram. But, I mean, if this leg was connected to here, there would be no difference between over and under here. Or more precisely, the difference will be epsilon. Because because if I'm sitting here, and I'm looking at there, and the distance here is 2 meters, and I'm moving this strand only 1 millimeters, the form is changing by epsilon. The integrand is changing by epsilon, and therefore the integral is changing by epsilon. So therefore, leg ends, the leg end from here cannot connect to a leg end corresponding to a different double point. Therefore, it must connect to its own double point. So the only way I could get a contribution is from this diagram. Now, for this diagram, this epsilon argument doesn't hold, because indeed I'm moving the this strand, the horizontal strand, by just a tiny amount, but I'm viewing it from a nearby place. I'm viewing it from a very nearby place, and I see it still looks like a big motion. So this might actually contribute something. Let's compute what does it contribute. Well, what does it contribute? Well, it contributes precisely, well, I mean, we've done this computation, in fact, when we talked about the linking number. Okay? So it contributes 1. Or the difference between, basically, if you're sitting down at the lower strand and you're looking at the upper strand, you see the entire upper hemisphere. And then you flip the upper strand to be below, and now you see the entire lower hemisphere. So the difference between the two is the entire volume of the sphere, which is 1, which was normalized to 1. So omega was supposed to be, the omega here is supposed to be a volume form of volume 1. So the difference between the two is 1. Likewise here. So you get this diagram with coefficient 1. No, I told you a lie. Almost with coefficient 1. You get this, but because, you see, I never told you which of the chords of the original diagram is this yellow cord. Right, this yellow cord could have been any of the cords appearing in a diagram D. Okay, so for any choice of a bijection between the double points of this diagram of the knot, for any choice of a bijection between the double points of the knot and the chords of a of our diagram, provided the order is, provided it's the same diagram, provided the chords are ordered in the same way as the double points, we get a contribution of one. So therefore, the contribution overall is the order of the automorphism group of the underlying diagram times the diagram itself. Sorry, the contribution to the integral is just the order of the automorphism group times one. Okay? And therefore, the this is the contribution, or this is more precisely, this is the value of IN of D on our knot K. But then, when you look back at Z0, Z0 has the value of the of I times the diagram itself divided by the automorphism group, by the order of the automorphism group. So therefore, in Z0, you get D divided and multiplied by the order of the automorphism group, so just D itself. Okay? And that's what I wanted to get. And this is the end of the proof. Okay? Sorry for the, I don't know, I don't know if I'm sorry. This is tough life. The automorphism group appears. Okay? Anyway, okay, so Z0 is a good, Z0 is what we want, provided wishful thinking is removed. Okay? So let me now erase all of this and try and start removing the wishful thinking hypothesis. So, okay, the boundary of configuration space of a diagram D for a knot gamma was equal to the set of principal faces, what we call principal faces. So these are the faces that occur when you have only two-point clusters. And the rest, which we want to argue is irrelevant, and the rest is the so-called hidden faces. And the hidden faces occur when you have clusters, or a cluster of size greater than or equal to 3. So let me just draw what this would look like. So first of all, let me call the cluster, give it a name, so call it C for cluster. And then the picture will be the following. So, you know, the part of configuration space that I look at like would look like, well, here is a piece of the cluster, or let's do a cluster of size precisely 3. So this is the cluster, and I'm circling it to sort of indicate that kind of this is viewed from a microscope. All of these points are kind of the same point on the manifold, except in the compactified space I've magnified. Okay? And then it has various edges going out of the cluster to other points in the to other points in R3. Okay? So that's what the picture looks like. And the thing I can say is that the part of D restricted to the cluster, so D restricted to the cluster, the part of the graph that I see inside here, may as well be connected, is connected. And the reason is that I never bothered to blow up things that were not connected by an edge. Okay? So if you go back to the definition of the compactification in the case of a graph, I've only blown up connected clusters because it was enough. Because I didn't need to know the direction of view between points that were not connected. Okay? Good. So now there are two possible cases. Actually, three, sorry. There are three possible cases, but two of them are good. So case one is the following. So the cluster C has a vertex, I don't know, let's call it A, which is connected to the outside. So I suppose this is the outside of the cluster, all of these things. Okay? Via only one, internal edge. Internal meaning non-skeleton. So, okay? So, in other words, the picture is the following. We have, here is our cluster. It has somewhere a vertex A. And it is connected to the outside only once, by only one edge. So this edge goes to the outside. And therefore, okay, now where could A be? It cannot be on the knot itself, because if it would be on the knot itself, then A would be disconnected, then it would be then the component, connected component of A ends at A, right? Had A be on the knot, had it been on the knot, it would not be connected to anything else. It would be a connected component of size 1, but I wanted my connected component to be of size at least 3. Okay? So, right, because remember, for the purpose of connectivity, sorry, I mean, is connected using only internal edges. Because for the purpose of connectivity, I only care about internal edges, because these are the only ones need to be blown. So, no, I'm telling a lie. The skeleton edges also need to be blown. I also care about. So why? Sorry. So why can I assume that A is an internal vertex? Let's let's wait with that. So, anyway, wait, why can I assume that A is, sorry, it bothers me. If A was on the knot, so, you know what, sorry, it's a homework for me, and I'll treat a smaller case. So now A is internal, and therefore it must connect to two more vertices, B and C. And now I actually don't care if B and C are internal or external, because I'm not going to do anything to them. They're going to stay where they are. But remember, okay, but let me describe an automorphism of configuration space. The automorphism will map the point A to the point, which is sort of the mirror image of it relative to the line between B and C. So in formulas, it's B plus C minus A. In pictures, this picture. So A is here, B and C stayed where they were, and the line going to the outside now is going this way. But notice that it has the exact same direction as before, because the outside is infinitely far away, so the fact that I moved A within its cluster doesn't change the direction of view to the rest of the universe. Okay? Now, what did this map do? This direction remains the same, except on a different sphere. Right. This direction remains the same, except on a different sphere. Up to interchanging two spheres, the map didn't do anything. Sorry, but no, that's not right. Here's what I want to say. Sorry, the map maps A to negative A, and this is orientation reversing. After orientation reversal, okay, I don't know, what should we call this map? Psi. So the picture is the following. We have the configuration space or more precisely, a piece of the configuration space, the boundary or piece corresponding to the cluster C, gets mapped to the boundary piece corresponding to the cluster C via this map psi, and this gets mapped by the direction of view map to some product of spheres. This map gets mapped by the direction of view map to some product of spheres. The diagram doesn't quite commute because two of the spheres got interchanged, right? This line became this line, and well, sorry, the line from B to A got replaced by the line from A to C, and the line from A to C got replaced by the line between B to A. So two of the spheres got interchanged. So there is some map over here, so that the diagram is commutative, but it's not the identity map. Nevertheless, interchanging two spheres is orientation preserving. So this map is orientation preserving. This map psi reverses the sign of one coordinate in a three-dimensional space. So it's orientation reversing. So this one is orientation reversing. Okay? So if you take the w to the e here, it pulls back to the same w to the e here, because I've just interchanged two W's, and then the W's commute. However, it's pulled back to, however, it's if you pull back the pullback of W via psi, it will go to the negative of this pullback of W. Okay, of the pullback via this direction map. So we found an automorphism of the space on which we integrate that takes the integrand to its negative. So the integral is zero. Okay? So the conclusion is the part of the integral corresponding to D coming from this boundary is zero. So I'm fully justified not considering it. I have 1 minute for the other case that I know how to do, and then I suppose next time I will have to explain why these two cases do cover almost entirely everything. Okay, so next case, two, so C has an internal vertex twice connected to the outside. Okay? So so the picture now looks like this. I have a vertex A, and it's connected to the outside in two ways. But then it has to be connected to somewhere on the inside. Okay? Let's call this place in the inside, on the inside, B. And B in itself has to be connected to two more places because, well, it has on, it must have three edges coming out of it. So let's call these two the two other places it connects to C and D. I'll have to wait. I'm running out of time. C and D are. C and D cannot be they cannot both be outside, because if both were outside, that would be a connected component of size 2. Okay? If one of them is outside and one is inside, we're back in the previous case. So they must both be inside. Okay? And then, again, I have an automorphism, and the automorphism is the automorphism that flips both A and B. So A goes to C plus B minus A, and B goes to C plus D minus B. And after the automorphism, the picture looks like this. So C and D remains where they were. B goes to the opposite place. A goes to the opposite to the opposite direction. So we now have a picture like this. The direction, the view to the outside remains the same, so we can ignore it. And these two directions get interchanged as before. The map here, psi, is now orientation preserving, because I am switching the signs on two things in R3. So something I'm taking, I'm switching the sign on R6. So the map psi is now orientation preserving. However, the direction of the edge between B to A flips sign. So if I pull back a volume form with a flipped sign, with the antipodal map, I get negative the volume form. So again, contribution is zero. And I'll stop here, but what I'll do next time is tell you that these two cases cover practically every, basically, you know, if you have an edge, sorry, if you have a vertex, it has to be connected to the outside either once or twice. It cannot be connected to the outside three times, because then it would be a connected component of size one. So therefore, what remains is diagrams that do not connect to the outside. The only trouble may ever come from diagrams that lie fully and completely within their cluster. Okay? And these diagrams are, well, the trouble for next time. Okay.